Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to Reverb. My name is Alex Helberg, and I am joined on the mic by my co-host and co-producer, Calvin Pollock.
Hey, Alex.
Hey there, Calvin. And we are joined, very excited to be joined for the first time ever on the mic, our co-host and co-producer, Olivia Burnett. How's it going, Olivia?
Hey, Alex. Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. So glad to have you here with us, Olivia, for your first time on the show with us, especially for the episode that we have in store today. Olivia, in your email to us, when we suggested that we were going to do this episode, and we talked about how the last episode that we did, we called this the squeakquel. What was the term that you said that we should use to refer to this new episode?
Well, I'm not sure because after the squeakquel, the chipmunk movie sort of get blurry in my mind. So I'm not sure if this one is the road chip or chipwrecked, but either way, we've got at least two more episodes I think we could get out of this delightful book.
Yes. Yeah. Ringing out this line of riffage once again for if you aren't a loyal fan of the show and haven't guessed it already, we are taking on Scott Adams' Win Bigly, Lessons in Persuasion in an Era Where Facts Don't Matter. Our old friend Scott, who many of you might know as the Dilbert guy, writer of the Dilbert comic strip, now canceled and reposted. Scott hasn't been making much noise lately, so we haven't had much of an excuse to really fire up the old Dilbert engine lately. But we wanted to return to this, you know, new year, new us. We are starting off the year strong with some new episodes, and we felt it was time to give the next chapter of Win Bigly its due. So I usually like to start off these rejoinder episodes with a framing question that I pose to my co-host that kind of helps prepare our minds to prime us, in the words of Scott Adams, for this episode. And my question for you is this. Calvin, Olivia, do you consider yourselves to be rational people?
I'll take this one first. No. 100% no. I have no idea. Basically, from day to day, what's going to happen in my life. I don't really make decisions according to goals. I just kind of bounce through the world and I feel things and let it all play out.
In the words of Thomas Pynchon, you're a yo-yo. You just like go up and down, you bounce around. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's mostly about food.
I mean, I can't say I blame you for that. Yeah. Olivia, what about you? Do you consider yourself a rational person?
I'll just say I got an A in my deductive logic class. I was nailing those proofs. It was like the class with the worst people I've ever met in my life. So I don't know if I want to consider myself a rational person, but I did do it. I tried it out.
So you didn't get along well with the logic bros?
They're like, this teacher lady, I have a question real quick. And I just kind of thought, like, I am paying to hear from someone who has a PhD in the subject, like not from like a 19-year-old who like sells solar panels on the side, but you know, we can't control these things, I suppose.
That's true. Yeah. You can only control the way that your mind works around them, right? And again, you know, we don't have to be friendly to be rational either. You just have to make sure that you ace those tests. So to my mind, as long as you got the grade, you certainly achieved rationality in that sense. So, well, that's good to know, because here's the thing. Scott Adams is going to tell us a little something about what it means to be a rational or irrational person. So this chapter, we are now on part two of Win Bigly, entitled How to See Reality in a More Useful Way. You'll recall that in the previous episode, Scott gave us his vision of why facts don't matter or why facts are irrelevant in our contemporary society, or it's not useful to think about facts from a reality-based perspective. So we start out here at the beginning of the chapter. I'm really not going to read through a lot of this because it's kind of this chapter is extremely long, and I really want to make sure that we get to hit the fun notes in the chapter here. So I'll just start off giving you a sort of basic rundown of what he's talking about here. So he starts us off with this chapter subheading called The Myth of the Rational Mind, talking about how students of philosophy remember that Plato talked about the subjective nature of personal realities in his Allegory of the Cave. Are both of you familiar with this specific philosophical track?
I mean, it's sort of like the way that we think that LaCroix has a fruit flavor. You know, we think that reality is based in something real, but we're just watching the shadows on the cave wall.
That's right. I think it was Derrida who once said the flavor is forever deferred in reference to LaCroix. So anyway, yes, the essence is really what we seek in something like that, but it forever eludes our grasp. Yes. So he talks about the fact that we all have this subjective nature of reality, and that various philosophers throughout time have kind of reinforced this idea that there is maybe not a real objective true world that we can see, but rather every bit of reality is kind of inflected through the way that we look at it. Yes,
so
go ahead,
the
Olivia.
The world of Dilbert, are we supposed to understand like the Dilbert universe is like Plato's world of forms?
Yes, that's
if
right.
If we kind of escape the cave, we will exist in a truly real state in this office with a talking dog et al.
I think that's what his comic has been trying to build towards all of these years, is that we all actually just have like little, like if we were to take off the veil of our assumptions and all of the ideological baggage that we carry around, we would see that we too have little like points of hair sticking out of our heads. We also, you know, we all have glasses on that don't have like, you know, eyes behind them.
So not the red pill, not the blue pill, a secret third thing.
Yes, we're talking about the dill pill. That's right.
Dill pill.
You have to. This chapter is going to be all about taking the dill pill. Oh my God! So he cites other philosophers in here. I'm just going to list them off here: David Hume, Immanuel Kant.
Nice.
Dan Ariely. Now, have you guys ever heard of Dan Ariely before?
No. I haven't. Certainly, not as much as I've heard of Immanuel Kant and David Hume. Like, I don't think Ariely is on that level. Am I wrong to assume that?
You're not wrong. He is essentially the behavioral economist at Duke University who very recently was kind of lambasted, went through a series of high profile academic controversies. He does work on dishonesty, as Adam says, how he lectures extensively on the topic of how humans believe that they are using facts and reason to make decisions, but in reality are easily swayed by bias from lots of different sources. His work is primarily on lying and misdirection. And as it turned out, Dan Ariely has had multiple allegations against him now that have surfaced of manufacturing and manipulating data as a basis for his studies. So
nice. That's meta.
Only further proving his point. It was our fault as mindless sheep who believed him. You know, no
that's
prophet
right.
Is acceptable in his own time.
Yeah, Ariely.
Well
he's,
said.
He's working on a monograph called Ariely on Ariely.
it's gonna be adapted into a one-man show coming to a town near you.
Yeah, Ariely on Ariely, starring
Ariely. Yes.
Yeah.
Next
in
up,
Ariely, Pennsylvania.
Such a place does exist. Next, we have Robert. I don't know how to say this name. Robert Cialdini. Is this one familiar to either of you?
Robert Cialdini.
Robert Cialdini. Cialdini.
No, but I think I might have made this joke when we were prepping. This sounds like a Sopranos, like a one-off Sopranos character, like a guy who Tony had killed in season 3.
Bobby C. Yes.
Yeah, Bobby C.
Yeah, no, Robert Cialdini is the Regents Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Marketing at Arizona State University. He's most often the cited authority on what is called in business schools persuasion. He wrote a book called Influence in 1984 that really basically went through these sort of 7 principles of how to persuade someone to believe what you do or do what you want them to do in a business setting. Just for a little bit of flavor context, when I was consulting with a computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon who was teaching a course on digital manipulation and persuasion, I learned that because I had asked him, what are you reading in the class from, you know, persuasion text? And Robert Cialdini was the main text that he was drawing from. I later learned that that class was not about how to identify and critically analyze manipulation and persuasion online, but how to do it and how to program
why
it into
it's good
why it's good and how to practice it. So
oh, that's cool.
It makes sense. Yeah, he's not an analyst, but a practitioner. The last one, the last of this murderer's row that he mentions of mostly behavioral economists is a guy called Nick Bostrom. So Nick Bostrom is this kind of theorist of artificial general intelligence and super intelligence, who is notable for theorizing or asking big questions like whether or not human beings are a real species or a simulation created by an intelligent civilization that came before. Nick Bostrom also, incidentally, had to issue an apology in January 2023 for a 1996 email where he had stated that he thought, quote, blacks are more stupid than whites, end quote, and where he had also used the N-word in a description of how he thought his statement might be perceived by others. So, again, not... just to say that, like, the people that kind of throw their weight around in these sort of, like... intelligence circles and you are kind of theorizing fast and loose about this. Yeah, sometimes need to be a little bit careful about the assumptions that they're making. So that's everything on Nick Bostrom. That is the sort of murderer's row that are in line with David Hume, Immanuel Kant, and Plato. Scott writes, I mention these brilliant philosophers and scientists because they would all agree that there are real limits on both human perception and human rationality. I encourage you to remain skeptical about any details in this book, but it might help you to know that I'm in good company, philosophically speaking, on the big picture. Humans think that they are rational, and they think they understand their reality, but they are wrong on both counts. Dun, dun, dun. So what do we make of this provocative first mic drop line in this chapter?
I'm really crossing my fingers, hoping and praying that he gives us a rational explanation for why human beings aren't rational. Like, please, please be some sort of like logical proof. I'm like, oh man, my weak, feeble human mind can't comprehend this. He's too rational. And I'm also wondering like how perhaps lizard people or something are going to factor into this. Like, did someone perchance like create humans? I want to know his entire cosmology. Like, where does he think we go when we die? Like, why are we here? I have so many questions for him.
We are going to find out, Olivia, so much about Scott's life, probably more than you ever wanted to know in the course of reading this chapter. But we will also get a little, you're incisive in pointing out the fact that we might get, I just want to really trace those words rational and irrational or reasonable and unreasonable as we continue to read along here. All right. So next up, under the next heading, Scott starts out writing. Want to see something freaky? Do you want to see something?
Absolutely not.
Not from Please. Scott Adams. So
there's going to be like photo inserts like, oh God, no.
No, thankfully he's not literally showing us something freaky here, but he says, set this book aside and do an internet search for, quote, the McGurk effect. Click on the first video you see, and it is short, and it will blow your mind when you see how powerful persuasion can be. So I am going to do something here, and I'm hoping that this is going to dub into the episode audio okay. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen with the two of you, and we're going to run a little audio experiment here that Scott says is going to teach us something very interesting about persuasion. Okay, so I have a video that's up here. You're going to hear a sound in just a moment, and I want you to tell me what it is that you hear. What did you just hear there?
I heard green needle.
You both heard green needle? Okay, yeah. Let's listen to it a couple more times.
I don't like this. I think this is Scott.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and stop the video and the sharing there. So what the McGurk effect is supposed to do is that when you hear a sound and see something on the screen, particularly when that sound is engineered to kind of sound like something else, you are intuitively inclined to agree with the thing that you see with your eyes rather than what you hear with your ears. However, I will also just say that both of you just kind of proved that wrong, or proved that it is kind of fallible, because when you both said that you heard the word green needle, the word brainstorm was actually what was up on the screen. And that is, you listeners at home, you may have also just heard brainstorm. You may have also heard green needle, because you could not see the words that were on the screen. So the McGurk effect, Scott says, is supposed to give us an idea of why our brains are irrational and why we are so susceptible to persuasion. What do you think of that?
Well, if that was supposed to blow our minds, I worry what will happen to Scott Adams when he hears about the dress.
Oh, like, my God.
Is it blue and black? Is it white and gold?
I'm sure Scott has a whole chapter on the dress coming later.
If not, he definitely wrote a blog post about it somewhere. I'm too lazy to look it up right now, but that has to exist.
Yeah.
So Scott writes on, "The main theme of this book is that humans are not rational. We bounce from one illusion to another, just like you, Calvin, all the while thinking we are seeing something we call reality. The truth is that facts and reason don't have much influence on our decisions, except for trivial things such as putting gas in your car when you are running low. On all the important stuff, we are emotional creatures who make decisions first and rationalize them after the fact. If you are normal, or anything like normal, you probably think I am exaggerating about how irrational we human beings are. Perhaps you don't feel irrational, but consider the U.S. election of 2016, in which Donald J. Trump unexpectedly beat Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College to win the election.
Can I just point something out?
Yes.
Whenever he pivots to this, which is really like his main, it's kind of the exigency for the book, is to explain this and to be like, and to remind us, like, I'm the guy who called it. Don't forget, the Dilbert guy told you that, you know, the Carnival Barker billionaire was going to win the election. No one else told you that that might happen.
I did. That's right.
And therefore it proves my theories of persuasion correct. But every time he pivots into it, it's so awkward and it's so divergent from what he had been talking about earlier in the chapter. And I'm just like, okay, you're going to show why, like, this theory of irrationality proves, you know, this extremely, as we've said before, overdetermined, weird example of a crazy thing happening, like, proves that that makes sense that that happened. But, like, I don't know if it's your best example, because it's so weird that that happened and that we're living in that reality.
I would say this is what, as a cognitive scientist, I would refer to as the CrossFit effect, where it doesn't matter what he's saying, because he has something in his heart that he wants to say, which is that he guessed the outcome of the election correctly, much like someone who does CrossFit. It doesn't matter how you open, it's going to end in CrossFit.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. That's a great comparison.
That is an incredible example. I'm going to start using that in everyday life. You've persuaded me, Olivia. You are clearly a master persuader, not just a cognitive scientist.
I've leveled up.
Yes, you've added a new cube to your persuasion stack.
Not just an acolyte in the ways of persuasion.
That's right. So Scott writes here, and I think you're right. He does very just awkwardly jump into this, and it's clear. This to me is an object lesson in the way to write a book that ages like a fine milk. It's not going to. This probably felt more relevant in 2017 when he wrote it. Every year after that, it just continued to decline in relevance and interest, especially as we approach another election. Now eight years after the 2016 one. This is really kind of feeling a bit passé at this point. So I think it is obvious, he writes, that roughly half of the people in the United States made a deeply irrational decision in that election. But which half? As a general rule, irrational people don't know that they are irrational. After the election results came in, both halves of the country accused the other half of being irrational. As a trained hypnotist, I can tell you with confidence that both halves were right.
What? Hang on. As a trained hypnotist. All right, that's a great way to start. That's a good opener.
This is what we like to call in rhetoric, establishing your ethos.
So hypnotism is when you have the power to decide if people were right or wrong about something. Am I understanding this correctly?
That's right. Well, as we're going to see here, being a trained hypnotist gives Scott some special powers into tearing open the fabric of reality and seeing how the underlying machinations work. So let's hear a little bit more about what he calls the persuasion filter. He writes, "The common view of reality is that the way you see the world is not only accurate, but universally shared. For all I know, that might be true. But it might also be the case that reality is something quite different from what you perceive. That possibility might feel unlikely to you. Watch me change your mind.
He's so close to having theory of mind. He's so close.
He's like, yeah, it's like, man, you know, just read some Kenneth Burke, read deterministic screens. Like, yeah, you're like onto something here, but
that's what I was going to say. Like for a second there, I was thinking, this is like the most hilarious, like ass backwards parody of Dana Cloud's Reality Bites.
Yes.
I mean, Reality Bites is like this, but steeped in actual theory and like actual political relevance. And it's just the weirdest bastardization of real theory.
Well, he was kind of on the edge of discovering that like other people have feelings, but then he took a hard left into like trained hypnotist territory. It's over for him.
No, you're exactly right, Olivia. And you're really invoking a sort of key theme that we've picked up on in this book before, which is that his vision of persuasion is kind of deeply, I don't want to say nihilistic. It's very solipsistic. He kind of presumes that he is the one person who can really show us the way here.
It's the view from the Dilbert office. I mean, this is like his, it's as if like the world of ideas and of politics is his blog, like, is it within the confines of his blog?
It is truly Scott's world, and we are all just living in it.
It's like the modern day forum, you know, Plato, Socrates discussing their ideas in the marketplace. Now we have Scott Adams on Twitter replicating this exact experience for all of us plebeians.
That's right. We have real coffee with Scott Adams, his daily live stream where he casually makes comments that can get his comic strip canceled from nationally syndicated newspapers. So here we go. He's going to do so. He's going to change our minds by explaining my personal journey through what I call the filters. The key concept of a filter is that it is not intended to give you an accurate view of reality. All it is supposed to do is give you better results than other filters. And I propose that the best way to objectively determine the usefulness of a filter is by asking if it makes you happy and also does a good job of predicting the future.
He synthesized postmodernism and utilitarianism in That's a way right. none of us could have imagined.
It's a way that, I mean, you're right there, Olivia, that it's like, is it useful for these two things? Does it make me happy? And does it also help me predict this is the thing that I still don't quite get, is like why he is so obsessed with predicting the future. Why, like, this is his sort of the hallmark of a master persuader, is somebody who can see beyond the fabric of time into this sort of, you know, different dimension. It's very strange.
I think maybe he could somehow use this to like play the lottery. Thoughts on this. I think that might be the only good in predicting the future.
You know, incidentally, he has not given us any winning lottery numbers as far as I can tell so far in this book, but I haven't done a numerological analysis on here. You know, like what every first letter of every paragraph, what does that correspond to numerically? Like I still have to do that. That's the next level of rhetorical analysis that I'm going to apply here. So he gives us a couple of examples of his different filters here that, again, only give us better results than other filters. Going through his lifespan, his timeline from childhood to adulthood by the filters that guided him. So the first one is called the Santa Claus filter. When I was a child, it was customary for adults to indoctrinate kids with an entertaining belief in magic of all kinds. For several years of my youth, I thought Santa Claus was real. I also believed in the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, and Superman.
Did he say several because he didn't want to drop, like, 15?
I think so, just for simplicity's sake here, for brevity. But, you know, I like that he also went outside of the traditional, like, you know, the traditional canon of household, yeah, you know, moral characters, and went straight to Superman.
That's a good
like,
point,
he believes
Alex,
that the DC universe is real.
Yeah, he kind of threw that in, like we're all being told by our parents that Superman is real. For
I never got told that.
20 years. It's like, no, what? No, you learn that it's a character. Like, I didn't think the Rugrats were real when I was six. Like, I understood that that was a show I was watching.
That would have been cool. I feel like we would have hung out.
They felt real.
So you guys didn't think that, like, people lived in your TV and would act something out for you?
No, we did not. But it's very prescient that you brought this up, Olivia.
That's great, because I totally never thought that either.
No, definitely, definitely not. We're going to learn here that Scott has got a thing for movies, and televised fiction is very
another
important
thing that I agree with him about.
Exactly. Scott knows that movies are where it's at. So the Santa Claus filter. My filter on life allowed all sorts of magical creatures to exist. The interesting part, and the lesson here, is that this total misconception about reality did an excellent job of keeping me happy and predicting the future. There was no penalty for being totally wrong about reality. I liked toys, and I liked knowing Santa was efficient, punctual, immortal, and suspiciously generous. I liked knowing that the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny would deliver the goods too. It was a great filter on reality until I was old enough to realize that there were simply too many chimneys and too little time for Santa to get the job done.
Wait, can you read that last part again? Until yes. I was older? Is that what he said?
Yes, that's right.
How much older?
Until he was old enough. He doesn't specify here, which makes me think that we're talking like he's like 15 or 16 or something. Yeah. Like that. By the time he could drive, he's like, wait a minute.
There's a lot of chimneys in this neighborhood.
Why didn't he call this book Too Many Chimneys, Too Little Time? Why don't we call this episode Too Many Chimneys, Too Little Time? I don't know if you've got something kind of on the back burner, like something coming that is going to be funnier than this, but it will be hard to top.
Just wait, Olivia. It gets a little bit wilder.
This is so boring too. Like, he's just telling us so much about his childhood. And I mean, the only thing that's interesting about it is just how stupid he was as a kid. Like, and I'm not trying to be rude to kids, but like I said, I fully understood what fiction was as a child, and not even that old of a child. I think by like five, I understood. Maybe four, three, I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's totally
fair. Not trying to flex or anything. But.
No, it's all good. It's all good. No, Scott's the only one doing the flexing here. So he talks here about how, you know, the numbers didn't add up. And there were other magical creatures that inhabited my filter. They also faded in the light of what I assumed was a higher level of knowledge and reason. But I was wrong. All I did was move on to another filter with new characters. So now we move on to the church filter. From the ages of about 6 to 11, I attended Sunday school at the Methodist church that was a short walk from my house. I believed everything the church told me because I didn't see any reason they would put so much energy into a centuries-long elaborate lie, and I assumed all those people couldn't be wrong. My church filter worked great most of the time. I was happy that I would go to heaven, but the filter didn't seem to do a great job of predicting anything while I was still alive. Prayers didn't seem to influence my outcomes in any reliable way, and no one could predict the next miracle or the birth of the next saint. I was starting to have my doubts about the church filter.
Maybe the birth of the next saint was you, Scott Adams. Maybe it was inside you all along. But I guess this also goes to show why John Wesley was not on his list of master philosophers and theologians and, you know, intellectual heavyweights that he is close personal friends with at the beginning of this chapter.
That's right. He goes on to narrate about how it was really only when he learned the Bible story of Jonah and the giant fish, or the whale in some other versions of the story, about how he sort of logics his way out of this puzzle, because he realizes that Jonah was none the worse for living in stomach acid without oxygen for 3 days. That was the tipping point for me, he writes. So it was like when he realized that one Bible story was illogical, he was like, well, this church stuff just isn't for me.
Yeah, I mean, those Israelites clearly had a empirical knowledge of whale biology.
That's
There's
right.
Nothing metaphorical about it at all.
No, the Bible is made up of facts, and Scott is literally in line with the most like biblical realist, like Pentecostal reading of the Bible, in that it's supposed to contain facts. And if it doesn't contain facts, well, then what's it worth anyway?
Such a weird way to describe your life. Like, my filters. Oh God, my filters.
Well, just you wait, because then once his church filter falls away, he comes up with a new one that's even better. The alien experiment filter.
Oh, Scott, no.
The alien experiment filter imagined that intelligent creatures from another world impregnated my mother so they could find out what happens when humans and aliens mate.
No, according to the
Hello, Sigmund Freud. We got another one.
According to that filter, the aliens were watching me at all times. He should have called this the Tom DeLonge filter. This would have been way better.
Well, Tom DeLonge is much cooler than Scott, honestly.
That's a good pantheon
of cranks. I'll put Tom DeLonge way
at,
way
at least we got angels and airwaves out of him, out of his alien experiment filter.
There's something in the back room. Hope it's not that creatures from above.
We just got this book. Oh man. So he said, I accepted this as true enough for several years of my childhood. The alien experiment filter did a good, by the way, this is all headcanon. He's not getting this from anywhere else other than just something that he made up. The alien experiment filter did a good job of explaining why I was so different from the people in my town, but it didn't make me happy, and it wasn't any good for predicting what would happen next. It wasn't a useful filter. Eventually,
the weirdo loser filter kicks in.
You're not too far off in the filter that's coming next, Olivia, which is eventually I drop that filter in favor of, I'll give you a chance to guess what this next filter, we got the church filter, then the alien experiment filter. What comes next?
I feel like it's gotta be a, like, why don't women like me filter.
Again, you might be guessing synonymously here, Olivia. Next up, the atheist filter.
This filter is that it's not, the filter here is that there's no filter at all.
Yes, exactly. He's getting into his philosophy bro era here. The atheist filter imagines that there is no supreme being. It also imagines that humans are rational creatures and they can understand their environment through observation, science, and reasoning. This filter was a perfect fit for a rebellious young man. It gave me something juicy to argue about, and I did whenever anyone would listen. Boy, hard to believe. Show me the proof.
And even sometimes when they didn't, it would seem.
That's right. As a general rule, I couldn't predict anything using the atheist filter. The atheist filter might turn out to be one of the more accurate views of reality, but that mattered less to me than the fact that it wasn't useful. It didn't make me happy, and it didn't help me predict what would happen next. But there were more filters to come. Next up, the weed filter.
Oh, no.
I smoked a lot of marijuana in college. One of the most puzzling aspects of being high was that the people around me who were not high seemed nicer than usual. For years, I assumed that I was only imagining that people were being extra nice to me when I was high. The simplest explanation for my subjective experience was that the drug was altering my perception of the world. I started to feel as if I had one reality when I was normal and an entirely different reality when I was high. In later years, I came to understand why everyone seemed so much nicer to me when I was high. It turns out that people were actually nicer to me, and there is a perfectly good reason. My cheery and relaxed attitude while high was rubbing off on the people around me. My other reality, the one in which I was not high, brought out more of my intense, ambitious, and introspective personality. So basically, he's just admitting straight out in his book, people don't really like me unless I'm a little stoned.
Really depressing. This is another example of like, Scott, this is not that interesting. Oh yeah, you got into your late adolescence and you got into atheism. You went to college and smoked weed. Wow, these are revolutionary experiences. Like, you're about to really changed the game with this one.
I just feel like he was also kind of on the brink here, where he almost discovered, if I'm nice to people, then they'll
be
like
nice
me.
To me back.
So close! Like,
hard left. Hypnotism school. This is the way.
Yes. Well, we're going to see where he goes wrong here. He writes, "The weed filter was a big improvement over my past filters because it made me happy, obviously, but it also had some predictive power. When I was high, I knew people would respond to me in a certain way, on average, and they did. Or so it seemed. And that's all that mattered. But the weed filter is limited at best." Next up, the mushroom filter.
Oh, God. It's just drugs. It's just like, wow, I found another drug. Amazing, Scott. This is not scholarship.
What is he like? And then I found the Pink Floyd filter. Now, this is a somewhat indie band that not a lot of people have heard of. So allow me to educate you.
Yeah. And I found out that you can play that one album and that movie, The Wizard of Oz, and they sync up and it's really sweet. It actually is really sweet. I hope he talks about that.
I'm just going to start listing off everything that I like have thought is cool for my entire life and just call that, like, you know, Taylor Swift had eras. I have filters. Scott Adams has filters. That's really what we're going through here. He's in his mushroom era.
Explaining vinyl albums to women.
Filter.
That's right.
I had the David Lynch filter. And then I discovered The Godfather. This was a great filter.
The Godfather filter.
It made me very happy. And I could predict, after I'd seen the movie 5 or 6 times, you know, I could predict that they were going to take the gun, leave the cannoli, you know?
Incredible. Yeah, it's got some real good predictive capabilities, especially when you've seen it like a dozen times. Oh, man. So when you are on mushrooms, you understand the world around you and you can operate within it. I'm skipping a little bit here because it's very kind of masturbatory.
Can you operate heavy machinery well with the mushroom filter on or no?
No comment from Scott on that one. He writes, "But at the same time, you become aware that your interpretation of reality is fluid. You see ordinary items almost as if you were an alien visiting a strange world for the first time. But for some odd reason, you know what everything is and what it does. In other words, you become aware that your perceptions are independent from the underlying reality." This is like such undergrad philosophy bro stuff. Oh, like, I can't even... Oh, man.
How many more filters are there?
Two more.
Okay. There's two more drugs that he learned how to do.
Yes. No, we've got his most contemporary filter, and then we get to the persuasion filter. Just as a coda to this section, he writes, "Kids, please don't take drugs. Drugs can be dangerous. I don't recommend trying marijuana or psychedelics. You get a similar perceptual shift by reading this book, and I've designed it to do exactly that. In other words, I took all those drugs so you don't have to. You're welcome." So, thank you, Scott. Also, really kind of hilarious to presume that kids would be reading this book.
Yeah, I'm tripping on, I'm going to take a, you know, a nature hike this weekend and trip on some Adams, some Scott. while looking at
ayahuasca? No. Adams. I brought this book to Coachella. It was crazy.
It was sick. I was able to
brought
sell
it to
pages.
Burning Man.
It made Tame Impala sound so much better when I had this book in front of me.
Crack open a little Scott Adams, put on a little purple haze in the background.
That's called Dilbert flipping. That's what that is.
That's right. Oh my God. So now we get to his contemporary filter, the one that he claims that he's still operating under, the one with probably the worst name of them all, the moist robot filter. Yeah, that's the correct. I'm not like Olivia's muted right now, but it looks like you're screaming into the microphone.
Just like horrified.
Yeah.
Shocked. Those were because moist was, I didn't have a lot of expectations. Moist was crazy. Robot was even crazier.
Yeah, we are.
How is this different than being impregnated by aliens?
Well, we're gonna find out. So he says here, the summary of the moist robot filter is that human brains are moist computers that can be reprogrammed if you know where the user interface is. For example, we know that going to school can change the physical structure of your brain by making it form new connections and new memories. That part is obvious. But there are lots of other ways to reprogram your brain to develop useful habits, change your energy level, hack your happiness, and more. The Moist Robot Filter assumes that your brain is subject to the laws of physics and doesn't have any magical qualities such as free will or a soul. So he says again, the Moist Robot Filter is the filter that makes me happiest, and it does the best job of predicting. The persuasion filter, the topic of this book, is a subset of the moist robot worldview. As moist robots, we are easily influenced by emotional and irrational factors. So that is the moist robot filter of reality that is giving rise to his theory of persuasion.
I don't like it. I don't like the phrase. I don't like the way that he's organizing these things and saying that persuasion is a subset of, I won't even use the phrase. I'm not going to use, I'll just call it the MRF, but I won't say the whole phrase. I will not defile my vocal apparatus with that phrase.
I mean, Scott would probably argue that by giving this phrase such a revolting name, he is actually hacking your brain to help you remember it better. So, you know, you just got served. You just got atomized.
I guess so.
All right, so now we finally get to his treatise on the persuasion filter. The most common opinion that we humans have of ourselves, I just have to flag, I don't know how many times he said that throughout the chapter, but it's like, whenever you read a phrase like that, it's like, no, I think that's what you, that's just something that you think.
Well, if I had one piece of writing feedback as a writing center tutor, I would say, if you're going to say, this as much as obvious, don't tell it to me then. If we all already knew it, you're just wasting my time.
That's right. That's exactly right. So for the purposes of demonstration, the most common opinion that we humans have of ourselves is that we are rational creatures, let's say 90% of the time anyway. But every now and then, we get a little emotional and temporarily lose our sense of reason. That's how most people see the world. I did too, until I became a trained hypnotist. Hypnotists see the world differently, so here we go again. From our perspective, our hypnotist perspective, people are irrational 90% of the time, but don't know it. We can be rational in trivial situations, such as deciding what time to leave the house to drive to work. Again, it's like, it's all stuff that's just like suburban guy stuff. It's filling up your car with gas. It's leaving the house to drive to work. It's Dilbert universe stuff. But we are almost never rational when it comes to matters of love, family, pets, politics, ego, entertainment, and almost anything else that matters to us emotionally. When our feelings turn on, our sense of reason shuts off. The freaky part is that we don't recognize when it is happening to us. We think that we are reasonable and rational most of the time. But what hypnotists have long known, and scientists have in recent years confirmed, is that our decisions are often made without appeal to the rational parts of our brain. We literally make our decisions first and then create elaborate rationalizations for them after the fact. Freaky, right? He literally wrote that in the
book.
That's
been like the 10th least freaky thing that has happened. Like, probably Moist Robots has got to be number one on the freaky list. It's like space, space, space. Like, maybe the alien thing. Nothing else has been like super freaky, I guess.
Yeah, and the only other thing that I would add is that he loves to make these sweeping proclamations about humanity and then presumably exclude himself.
That's right.
I don't know what...
Well, he's a hypnotist. That's what sets him apart.
Right. That's right. He's a hypnotist. But, I mean, based on his own account, he was a very stupid child and honestly a very stupid young adult. So I don't know like why I would believe that he's the most rational and like least subject to whims and impulses. I mean, he had sort of like the most entry level college experience that I've ever heard described. So I don't know.
Yeah, skeptical of it. Humility is not something that Scott has been notable for in his writing thus far, I would say. And really, I do think that that's kind of what sets this apart, because like most other theories of, you know, persuasion, rhetoric, whatever you want to call it, anything that's actually worth its salt will probably have to mention somewhere in there some some mention of like the author's own subjectivity and a sort of like, we are all subject to this kind of thing. I am no different than you. I'm just trying to think about this from a more sort of intersubjective perspective. We might call this a sort of, you know, human impulse to try and connect with other people or try to empathize with them. We don't really get a lot of that from Scott, as we've already established. And it really doesn't seem like there's more of it coming here.
I think there's some literary merit here if you read this book as if like Scott Adams is sort of talking to himself, sort of like the Green Goblin.
So many good things all happening for you, all for you, Norman.
What do you want?
To say what you won't, to do what you can't, to remove those in your way.
The board members. You killed them.
We killed them.
We?
Remember?
Then you can see his inner struggles as he tries to rationalize not being rational, because he's just now getting to this point, you know, in his advanced age. He's finally, like, after he stopped believing it in Santa at age 17, he's a little bit behind the curve on realizing many things. And I think that if we take this as like a work of fiction with an unreliable narrator, there's something really tragic and really beautiful about it.
That's a good point. It's a kind of autofiction, postmodernist autofiction.
Man, I really wish that I liked Scott Adams enough to give him that benefit of the doubt. But I do think that that's a good way to stomach the rest of what's to come, certainly.
Maybe Scott Adams is a character in Dilbert's mind rather than the other way around. You know, the guy in the office, like he wrote Scott Adams rather than the other way around.
Yes. Yeah. We've got some mix between Exit Through the Gift Shop and Saint Elsewhere going on here. It's a very strange framing narrative for where Scott comes from and why he does the things that he does. So now Scott gives us an example. Here's an example of why the idea that humans are rational is pure nonsense. One of my Twitter followers copied President Trump's inauguration speech and showed it to a, quote, leftist friend, telling him it was President Obama's speech. His friend loved it. I watched President Trump's inauguration address on television while live streaming to several hundred people on the Periscope app. Aw, what a quaint time. Most of the people who commented to me directly were touched by the inclusiveness and optimism in Trump's message. There were many tears. But within the hour, I also received an email from one of my best friends, a virulent anti-Trumper, who said this. I was quite surprised by Trump's speech. I thought all inaugural addresses include soaring language and hope for the future. This one sounded like his stump speech, but without the insults. Lots of anti-Washington rhetoric. It was the most negative tone I can remember hearing. No, ask not what your country can do for you. No, shining city on the hill. I also expected to hear more reaching out to others. Not all of you voted for me, but I will be president of all the people. That used to be pretty standard stuff as well. I guess Trump just does it his way and we need to get used to it. That's what the friend said. That interpretation is literally the opposite of what I, Scott Adams, heard and saw. This odd difference in observation is not unusual. Both my friend and I follow politics. We're both smart. He's smarter. At least he has the humility to admit that. Neither of us lied about our reaction to Trump's speech, but we saw entirely different movies playing on the same screen at the same time. If you think this different movies situation is rare, you're living in what I call the second dimension. In the third dimension, where persuasion rules, it is entirely normal and routine for different movies to play on the same screen at the same time. But if each of us is living in our own little movie, which one is best?
He's so close to developing theory of mind. It's like these chimp experiments where we're like, I left the room. Can you tell, like, if I know what box the banana is in? I don't think he could, but I think he's really on the verge of a breakthrough.
Yeah, he's going to get to the level of in semi-intelligent chimp at some point here. Oh my God.
I kind of don't believe the leftist friend story. You know, I mean,
no, neither do
I. One of those things where, like, you know, list of things that didn't happen. This goes on that list. Like, most leftists could read the text of a Trump speech and know that it's a Trump speech without you telling them it's a Trump speech. Like, he has a very specific, even the ones that are written by advisors, it's still in the transcript would be like, clearly, like, we clearly have like Trumpist elements to the language. So I don't believe that someone, first of all, wouldn't just immediately recognize that it's a Trump speech, and second of all, would claim to like it. So I think it's just completely made up, which is one of the best things about this book. He can just completely make up like 99% of it.
It's called persuasion. Yeah, it's when you just make things up that are true in your reality because they make you happy. And
yes,
they allow you to believe whatever you want to believe.
No, Olivia, you are like actually really spot on with what I think is the kind of nugget of Scott Adams' theory of persuasion, is just that if you argue forcefully enough that something is the way it is and you get, you know, no pushback, or you find ways to write off other people's pushback as irrational, laden with cognitive dissonance and confirmation bias, and as long as you have a series of like toadies and acolytes who are willing to also agree with you, then you can essentially go through life thinking that you are the most brilliant persuasion hypnotist, whatever, like master persuader in the universe. It's astonishing.
And that's why I always get to pick the movie, you know?
That's right.
It's my master persuader skills.
Movie.
Everybody's gotta pick which movie is best. So we go through here in this next part of the chapter. I mentioned cognitive dissonance and confirmation bias because those are things that actually did come up in the other chapter. Scott expands on them in a little bit more detail here, but honestly, not a lot of it is really worth reading through. He literally starts the section on cognitive dissonance, giving us the Wikipedia definition of cognitive dissonance. And so I just really want to skip to one part that, going back to what Calvin was saying before about the fact that, you know, you don't believe the story that was telegraphed to Scott about a Twitter follower who talked about a leftist friend. It's very clear that Scott puts a lot of stock into what he sees on Twitter and is very motivated by the interactions that he has on Twitter. So he has a subsection under cognitive dissonance called Spotting Tells for Cognitive Dissonance. And he writes here, "When I see someone on Twitter get triggered into cognitive dissonance, either by me or by anyone else, I often see a similar pattern of response. The pattern is so persistent that it is spooky. And once I describe it, you'll start seeing it all the time." So his pattern for cognitive dissonance is a mocking word or acronym plus an absurd absolute, or a mocking word or acronym plus a personal insult that is more aggressive than the situation seems to warrant. So he's literally just telling it like this is what his mentions are full of.
That's what I was going to say. So for Scott, cognitive dissonance is just getting dunked on. Like, that's, yes, it must be cognitive dissonance is why my mentions are a war zone.
He literally says the most common mocking words and abbreviations on Twitter are these: wow, OMG, so dot dot dot, in other words dot dot dot, ha 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 ha, all caps, exclamation mark, the exaggerated laugh, and finally dude, no punctuation.
Not to be, you know, a hater, but only one of these is an abbreviation. None of them are actually,
no, that's right,
they're just words.
Yeah. Yeah. He did say common mocking words and abbreviations, but
and abbreviation. Just yes. Like a grammar note on this book. Otherwise, no notes.
You're right.
These are things people say on Twitter. He's correct. Mm-hmm. So
they're also just things people say.
How many conversations is he having with people in real life?
Good point.
It's a very good question. His examples draw a lot from online. And so I'm thinking the answer to your question, Olivia, is probably not much.
Because it seems like he's off the weed filter. So it seems as if his old college friends are not hanging out with him. Unclear, but
basically our advice, our non-professional advice to Scott for this episode is, Scott, start smoking weed again. You gotta, that's the only way that you're gonna, that your life is you're going to be happier and you can predict stuff again. Like that's what you want, right?
I think this book could qualify him for like a med card, probably.
Yeah, if they don't want to read the whole thing, you know, Scott, you can tell them to listen to our podcast.
Where does so, Scott live? Do we know
that's,
that?
That's a great question. One of our listeners, can we please get an address for Scott Adams? We'll read it out on the next pod. Anyway.
Yes.
So he concludes this section by saying, as a public service, I described in my blog a way to know you won an argument on the internet by spotting cognitive dissonance. So he's literally saying, like, you know, the fact that you're making fun of me means that I won. That's not really as important as the last thing that I want to get to here before we round out the chapter, which is a section called Mass Delusions. So this is where the persuasion filter goes a little bit awry for Scott. If you don't know how frequently mass delusions occur in your daily experience, many of your opinions about the world are likely to be nonsense. That's because mass delusions are the norm for humanity, not the exception. Don't believe me? It's easy to check. Just ask your neighbors about their religious or political views. You'll find plenty of disagreement with your worldview. And so, according to you, your neighbors and all the people who agree with them must be living in some sort of hallucination. How can they believe that they are reincarnated when you know that death means either heaven or hell? You and your neighbor can't both be right. One of you, at least, is experiencing a little piece of a larger mass delusion. So, what do you think about this kind of quotidian example of a mass delusion experienced by neighbors?
I mean, my whole thing with Scott and this example of his neighbors is like, this is just having beliefs, like beliefs.
Literally.
So we're just equating beliefs with delusions. Why is he trying to like reinscribe like basic cognitive science, but in much stupider, like blog-like terms? I don't know what we're getting out of this other than saying, I guess it allows Scott to feel a lot smarter than the people he's talking about. That's really what the goal here seems to be.
Well, only smart people could publish a book. So
that's true.
There's that.
That's right.
And yeah, and have a successful comic strip.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. No, I really do think that it all kind of does come back to this idea that, like, again, Scott can't countenance the idea, like the complexity of people's beliefs, to say nothing, you know, like metaphysics and stuff like that. Remember, he left his church filter behind at, you know, like age 11. He already went through his atheist filter, and that seems to be the thing that kind of really stuck with him through the, like, the weed filter and the mushroom filter could have done a little bit more to help him empathize. But like, now he's literally just saying everyone else is suffering from mass delusions, and like, you know, what you sheeple call belief, I really realize is just an example of like a massive deception that you are falling for. He gives several examples of real mass delusions that, again, he literally got from Wikipedia. He cites it here. Wikipedia lists over 30 examples of mass hysteria through the years. So again, just like rigorous research process for Scott. He didn't even take the trouble to bibliography mine. Like, there's certainly a published, like, peer-reviewed encyclopedia that has a list of these. But it's just like, he's blogging in a book. The Salem Witch Trials, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, in which people thought that a radio play was actually happening in real life. The McMartin Preschool Trial, which I did not actually know about this one. He also cites Tulip Mania, how in the 17th century, the Dutch became so enamored with tulips, a flower that was new to them, that they bid up the price of tulip bulbs to about 10 times the annual income of a skilled worker. So again, tulip mania as an example of a mass hysteria, and not the first example of a boom bust cycle, which is really just a feature of capitalism that has stayed with us ever since.
Question for Scott Adams: is capitalism a mass delusion?
Very good question. I would be curious to hear Scott's take on this. The point here is that in the 2D view of the world, mass delusions are rare and newsworthy. But to the trained persuaders in the third dimension, mass delusions are the norm. They are everywhere. They influence every person. This difference in training and experience can explain why people disagree on some of the biggest issues of the day. So if we were all just hypnotists like Scott and saw the world in three dimensions rather than two, we would all also realize that we are just victims to one of a series of mass delusions, aka beliefs.
It's beliefs. I mean, it's just, you know, and we have lots of tools in rhetoric and discourse studies for understanding these, like ideological analysis and commonplaces and tropes and
ideographs.
We got a million ways to look at this.
But why? Where else can you get a sizzle concept like mass delusions from
mass
Scott?
Mass delusions. It does sound very sci-fi and cool.
It does. So he's going to, again, give us an example here. On top of our mass delusions, we also have junk science that is too often masquerading as the real thing. To the extent that people can't tell the difference, that too is a source of mass delusion. For example, consider the case of global warming. People from the 2D world assume that mass delusions are rare, and they apply that assumption to every topic. So when they notice that most scientists are on the same side, that observation is so persuasive to them. A reasonable person wants to be on the same side with the smartest people who understand the topic. That makes sense, right? But people who live in the 3D world, where persuasion rules, can often have a different view of climate change because we see mass delusions, even among experts, as normal and routine.
So is the third dimension with the hypnotist and everything, is it just like opposite world? So like when scientists say something, you do the opposite of it because they're deluded?
Well, his point here, I think, is that when it's not just when a scientist says something, but it's when a whole bunch of scientists all come to the exact same conclusion, which, you know, if you are a scientist, is like the point of good science, is that other people could come to the same conclusion that you did given the same data and environment that you conducted the experiment within. But he is saying that that is actually evidence of a mass delusion.
So like more agreement equals more delusion.
Yes. Okay. Michael Crichton, we actually did an analysis of this in a very early episode of this show, called this consensus science. Michael Crichton, right, of course, a virulent climate change denier, in addition to the author of the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World books. But he really also came to the same conclusion. If enough people are just in agreement about this, then, and they also try to ostracize and financially and psychologically pressure other scientists who try to challenge them away from that conclusion, then therefore you must be dealing with a mass delusion.
Yeah, I mean, we have something called the rhetoric of science, and we look at these questions, we think about how scientific fields and scientific knowledge are not totally objective. They're intersubjective, like all fields of knowledge, and that, like, those intersubjective relationships get played out through a series of norms, discourse norms, and like knowledge representation norms and genres and texts. But I don't think Scott is that nuanced in his treatment of it. I think he just wants to say, in a kind of like entry-level freshman dorm room postmodernist way, like, all knowledge systems and all belief systems are equally valid, so I can just pick and choose what I want from the 3D world, and whatever like flatters my ego is therefore true, and the rest is mass delusion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it doesn't give us very much else to really like measure the validity of his like 3D world approach, other than literally saying in the 2D world, the scientific method and peer review squeeze out the bias over time. But in the 3D world, the scientific method can't detect bias when nearly everyone, including the peer reviewers, shares the same mass delusion. He continues, "I'm not a scientist." No kidding. "And I have no way to validate the accuracy of the climate model predictions. But if the majority of experts on this topic turn out to be having a mass hallucination, I would consider that an ordinary situation. In my reality, this would be routine, if not expected, whenever there are complicated prediction models involved. That's because I see the world as bristling with mass delusions. I don't see mass delusions as rare.
Is a mass delusion and a mass hallucination, are they different? Because he's been using the terms interchangeably. Because to me, that would feel like they're seeing visions of like the ice caps melting or something, versus the scientific method was designed to reinforce things that don't line up with Scott Adams's reality. I don't know if that doesn't make a difference, if it just means to an end anyways, and it doesn't really matter how they arrived at these wrong conclusions. For all we know, they could have hallucinated.
Yeah, that is pretty much, I mean, I do think that's just a case of sloppy prose where he's just kind of using these terms interchangeably. But again, yeah, exactly as you're saying, it's more the sort of like, you know, they're arriving at a conclusion that I have no way of understanding myself. The only thing that I can conclude, because for me, my confirmation bias about the world, although he doesn't talk about it that way, is that mass delusions are the norm. There are no ways of having a quote unquote rational belief or finding your way to a reasoned position via argument in a way that we rhetoricians might tend to think about things. Instead, no, you are just a victim of your sort of irrational emotional impulses that force you to believe what other people are pressuring you to believe. Very bizarre.
Yeah. And I just, does he not know kind of what Olivia was just alluding to? Like, the climate scientists have like tools and like machines that can accurately measure the size of ice caps over time and like pretty directly produce evidence of what's causing that to happen. Like, does he not know that, or does he not care enough?
So you're saying they have robots that aren't moist?
I guess so. Yeah. Or they were moist, but now over time have become much less moist.
Scott is the only dry robot in the house here. He's the
dry boys. Yeah.
He's the only dry bot. So
dry Scott.
So now, of course, like everything else in this book, we have to bring it back to Trump. To put it another way, if an ordinary idiot doubts a scientific truth, the most likely explanation for that situation is that the idiot is wrong. But if a trained persuader calls BS on a scientific truth, pay attention. Do you remember when Citizen Trump once tweeted that climate change was a hoax for the benefit of China? It sounded crazy to most of the world. Then we learn that the centerpiece of politics around climate change, the Paris Climate Accord, was hugely expensive for the United States and almost entirely useless for lowering temperatures. Experts agree on both points now. The accord was a good deal for China in the sense that it would impede its biggest business rival, the United States, while costing China nothing for years. You could say Trump was wrong to call climate change a hoax, but in the context of Trump's normal hyperbole, it wasn't as wrong as the public's mass delusion believed it to be at the time. So again, it's like this goes back to a point that he made in a very early chapter, which is that Trump goes to like an extreme in one direction. And then as it turns out, he's actually right about like one little, because his extraordinary position encompasses so many different assumptions. It's like literally like using a shotgun to hit the broadside of a barn. At least one of those things is going to hit.
So in this universe, is Trump the ultimate arbiter of reality, or is Scott Adams? Like, is Scott Adams like the prophet of Trump?
That relationship has always been a little bit murky. It seems to me that Scott is the prophet of Trump, I think, in kind of the way that he's telegraphing him here. That seems to be what my remembrance of the introduction was.
Because I'm kind of feeling like maybe Scott Adams is sort of like John the Baptist, and he's like, make straight the way of Trump.
Yes.
Like, there's one who is coming whose, you know, bootlaces I cannot untie.
Scott the Baptist, yeah.
That seems an apt metaphor. So now we get another example from Trump and more movies. When the presidential election of 2016 was over, reality split into two movies. Trump supporters believed that they had elected a competent populist to drain the swamp and make America great again. Their preferred media sources agreed, but anti-Trumpers had been force-fed by both the mainstream media and Clinton's campaign a fire hose of persuasion that said Trump was the next Hitler. In effect, the Trump supporter and the anti-Trumpers woke up in different movies. One movie is a disaster movie, and the other is an inspirational story. The fascinating thing about this situation is that each of us can operate in a world and do things we need to do to survive. You and I can both go shopping, both drive cars. There it is again. We all have to drive freaking cars for Scott. Both have jobs and have friends. Living in completely different realities is our normal way of living. We usually don't see it so starkly as we did the week after the election. The two-movie split in our reality wouldn't have happened if Clinton had won, as most experts expected. In that scenario, everyone would simply be living in a world that was a lot like the one they were already in. But Trump's unexpected win created a persuasion bomb that no one knew how to defuse. The anti-Trumpers were locked in their Hitler movie, and confirmation bias would keep them there. It was a terrible situation for a country, and it was an enormous challenge for Trump, the master persuader.
But Bill Murray woke up in a third movie where he was forced to live the same day over and over again.
Which is incidentally kind of what the Trump presidency actually felt like from the perspective of someone who is critical. It's just like, okay, we're waking up and okay, he said something crazy again. Okay, all right, well, things are just continuing to get steadily worse. Yeah, it's basically just Groundhog Day.
Yeah, I am kind of honestly pretty into this two movie theory of reality. Like, there's always two movies. Like, I don't know what the two movies are right now. I guess it's like Dune 2 and what's the other movie? I mean, I guess it's just Dune 2 right now. There's one
right
movie.
Now it's just Dune 2. We had
took us back to a one movie reality.
That's Madam Web Erasure.
Oh, Madam Web Erasure. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so it's Dune 2 and Madam Web. Those are the two movies.
That's right. I mean,
always two at any time.
We did have Barbie and Oppenheimer over the
Barbie
summer.
That was
Barbenheimer
movies,
was a two-movie reality. It's very true.
Yeah.
So he continues on here, how Trump is trying to challenge the quote-unquote Hitler movie, which is what he continues calling this. I think it's kind of hilarious.
I don't really like that.
I don't like it either. It turns out Trump was up to the challenge. The solution to the Hitler movie is to act non-Hitlerish in public until people can no longer maintain the Hitler illusion and it falls apart. And that's how Trump and his running mate Pence played it. They quickly moderated some of their more extreme campaign positions so they looked like they were heading away from Hitler mode, not toward it. People are more influenced by the direction of things than the current state, so Trump changed the direction.
He pretended to act like he wasn't Hitler, but what was, dear Mr. Adams, in reality happening?
That's the thing. It's like, it feels like he's just kind of... Also, I don't believe that Trump ever broke out of the Hitler movie. Like, I don't buy that premise. Like, I think you can convincingly say that.
This was a classic case of he accidentally said the quiet part loud, where he's like, Trump pretended like he wasn't acting like Hitler.
Yeah.
So that he could win voters. Yeah. Well, like, he had to hide his actual goals in order to win voters in the election.
That's right. Well, and let's hear some direct examples from Scott of how Trump was fighting, how he introduced the Barbie to the Oppenheimer, a Hitler movie that he was in. Trump signaled his direction away from the authoritarian rule in several high-profile ways. Number one, President Trump's most notable change involves scaling back his deportation plans by focusing on undocumented immigrants who committed serious crimes after entering the country. Trump also worked with Congress and the judicial system, like an ordinary politician, trying to get an immigration ban on several countries believed to be high risk in terms of future terrorist attacks. By failing on his initial attempts and working within the system, he looked nothing like a strongman leader.
So he's using the Muslim ban as an example of him not being Hitler. Okay,
yes.
Got it.
And great. Also his actual immigration crackdowns, which again is using the kind of rhetoric of undocumented immigrants who commit serious crimes after entering the country, which, oh man, there's so much frame shifting going on here that you, ugh, man. Trump dropped support for waterboarding and he stopped talking about going after the families of terrorists. Boy, what a great guy he is.
So moderate.
He's really giving me the Hitler particle concentration is really going down here for me. Trump ordered a 59 Tomahawk missile attack on a Syrian airbase as a response to allegations that Syria used chemical weapons. Even Trump's critics, like Hillary Clinton, called it measured and presidential.
Oh, great. So the fact that Trump did the same imperialism that Hillary wanted to do, that's proof that he was very moderate. Got it.
That's right. Trump's critics strained to maintain their framing of the president as a dictator, but his actions no longer provided the high-quality ammunition that his pre-election provocations did, and that allowed the Trump is Hitler illusion to begin the process of evaporating. By the time you read this book, some of the events I mentioned might look different, but you can see that Trump got the direction right. He was clearly trending away from the Hitler label and towards something that looks more like a regular president.
Why wasn't he a regular president in the first place? First question. Second question, wouldn't Scott Adams be able to predict the way that these policies are going to look at the time we're reading this book and then like let us know?
That's really, again, if he's able to predict the future as he so confidently says that he is, he should be able to tell us. The truth is, actually having gone through, this is why we're going back and looking at this in hindsight in 2024 to say that, like, no, he really didn't scale back any of the really bad stuff. Like, he mostly followed through on what he said he was going to do. And most of it was pretty disastrous and pretty bad. You know,
yeah.
Also, where does Scott talk about COVID in here? He doesn't talk about a global pandemic anywhere. Seems like a little bit of an oversight for a clairvoyant.
That would have been helpful if he had predicted that. I mean, he predicted Trump's election. Could he have predicted the pandemic and saved all of our lives? That would have been some great using hypnotism for good. I don't know. I mean, I do think, like, in a weird way, he's backing into a useful point, which is that, like, Trump has kind of been metabolized by our society into being a normal president. And I think that's, but that points to like much larger structural problems in how we process information about politics and how we like continue to talk about politics after political events have passed. I don't quite understand how his theory helps us deal with that. Like, he seems to be basically saying that it was all mass delusion to be concerned about Trump, and Trump's own actions showed that was just a fake movie in liberals' heads. But like, the reality is that he was a very terrifying leader, and we have this sort of we have these processes of normalization that occur at scale and that happen over many, many years, and like over a lot of individual conversations and rhetorical processes, and especially media coverage that kind of just like they use the same sort of standard news media genres to cover Trump as they used to cover any other president. As a result, because that's the first draft of history, we now talk about Trump as though he was normal.
That's why I think that example of the missile strike on the Syrian airbase is such a telling example of the sort of like, you got this, you know, a similar reaction to like the Bush era shock and awe of like, you know, the original, like the bombing of Fallujah. You know, when you see this kind of like naked interventionist imperialism taking place, and all of a sudden it's like, ah, yes, this is the thing that, you know, NBC, owned by General Electric, also a major weapons contractor, is also really in favor of you know, broadcasting and talking cordially about. It's presidential now when he does this, which again, I mean, this is also just to say Scott's theory of persuasion does not have a theory of like material conditions. It does not have any sort of like economic grounds to it. For Scott, I mean, this literally, I mean, he is kind of like a, what you might call a sort of like magical discursivist. The idea that it is through discourse alone you can achieve these massive shifts in reality without, you know, say being a billionaire and having the ability to like garner a bunch of support from media corporations that you've spent your entire career being around and playing. Like, there's like none of that really makes its way into it. Like, it's truly for Scott just at the level of his language and his public presentation that any of this is happening, which is just kind of very silly on its face.
He's an extreme idealist in that he views, like, let's just stay with the two movie theory, because I'm having trouble like keeping his entire theory in mind at one time, but the two movies helps me remember his point. So like, let's just say that like Scott believes there are two movies. There's the lib movie and the conservative movie. And like the lib movie is saying that Trump is this awful Hitler president, but Trump did things to make that movie less popular over time, and then like a better movie took over or something. But like my question is, where is Scott in this entire constellation of ideal movies
I would
operating?
Say, I think he's sweeping up the popcorn afterwards.
Okay.
As somebody who used to work as a popcorn jockey and as a theater cleaner in a movie theater, I think that that's a noble position to give Scott. He's the one who gets to watch the credits roll. He understands the people who are behind it all. And like the fact that, you know, yeah, every movie has an ending. The credits always roll. There's always somebody behind the curtain, you know, like he's the guy who's ready to pull back the veil on this whole movie magic thing that we're all having fun experiencing.
And perhaps only Scott has the ability to leave the theater.
That's right. We're back to Plato's allegory of the cave. It's Plato's movie theater. That's actually not a bad that's not a bad kind of end coda for this. I would read you the very last part of this chapter, but I kid you not, the entirety of this chapter contains like several pages called The Making of a Hypnotist, where he literally talks about his training as a hypnotist, and it's just like it's too much. So we might reserve
that. Why did we waste all this time on this political crap? I want to know about his hypnotism career.
I promise you, we will make this a part of another episode. But
has he actually hypnotized people? Like, does he talk about that in this section?
Allegedly, yeah, he does. I mean, he literally talks about how he's been interested in it since he was a child. He did it when he was in San Francisco. He found it easy to get volunteers for hypnotism. And he talks about, you know, sort of like what makes a good hypnotism candidate. Talks about the fact that you like have to be willing to buy into the illusion and all that. So it's like, it's nothing terribly new or exciting, but of course it's in Scott Adams' purple prose. So it's going to be bad whenever we get around to this. So any final thoughts on how to see reality in a more useful way? The myth of the rational mind, the filters, the mass delusions.
Well, if grad school doesn't work out for me, how would you say the hypnotism job field is looking right now?
Scott actually does have some advice on this that I can give you here. After the section on this one is called Hypnosis Superpowers, let's see, lie detection, romance, communicating. He does talk about pickup artistry in this section too. So that I feel like is worth covering on another episode all by itself. But he does have this little section here at the end called Finding a Hypnosis School. By now, some of you are wondering how you can find a hypnosis school of your own. See how I anticipated your question, or at least some people's questions? Olivia,
wow, Olivia,
he predicted.
He did. Perfect.
Unfortunately, I can't help you on this question because I have experience with only one hypnosis school and it no longer exists. They trained him and then they were like, shut it down.
Shut it down. We can't do this anymore.
So you predict my question and you're not even like, I'm going to do a quick Google search for hypnosis schools near me. Because I did that. I'm not even writing this book. And I had the foresight to think I could Google hypnosis average salary, you know, hypnosis training programs, hypnosis online certification. He couldn't have done any of that for his readers who by now have made it hundreds of pages in to this horrible, horrible book.
At this point, he does say, if you find a hypnosis school locally, so if you do Google that question, be sure to ask for references from past students, but be skeptical of the references for two reasons. One, the school will connect you only with students they know will say good things. And two, a good hypnotist could give students the impression that they got more value than they did. But don't worry.
Are they hypnotizing their students into thinking that they're hypnotists?
Where does it end? It's hypnotism all the way down for Scott. And it's just not a world I want to live in.
I don't get, how did this like all get in the book? I mean, I understand that this was not like there was no real editorial process for this, but like you'd think even Scott would reread some of this and be like, I am now giving practical advice on finding hypnotism schools in like this section
not,
of
though.
This chapter. Yeah.
That's true. He's alleging to, but he's not.
He's alleging to, that's true.
I think it's like a braided narrative. I think all the pieces will come together at the end.
It very well
it's
might.
It's like Lost. It's like Lost. You got to get like seven seasons in and then it starts to kind of make sense.
But as Scott reminds us, it's when it's really the direction that matters more, right? The fact that he pushed you in the direction, Olivia, of thinking about going to hypnotism school, that's really all that matters.
Has he correspondence hypnotized me just by listening to his words?
Maybe so. I mean, we're doing a podcast about him. So, you know, maybe we're all taken up in this grand mass hallucination that Scott has implicated us within.
Well, as long as we don't say, lol, wow, dude, okay, or sorry, he hasn't won yet.
That's
we
right.
We can build the mental fortitude to escape both the two movies and the theater that Scott has built brick by brick to imprison us all in his trap.
The two movie theory of reality. I like that. You know, there's just two movies at all times. Which one are you watching? I did see Dune 2 last night. And it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Highly recommend.
Better than
the
first one.
That's the movie I'm watching. Oh, I mean, I love the first one too. I don't know how to rank them, but highly recommend.
I've been told that I need to watch The Holdovers.
Love The Holdovers.
Was
love
it good?
Yes. All right.
I loved it.
Yes.
I thought excellent. It was cute.
Excellent. Yeah. I've seen
that's
I've
another
seen...
movie. That was wait, The Holdovers was it was like The Holdovers and Napoleon at that time. There were two movies.
That's right. Those were the two movies.
Yeah. You pick a day on the calendar year and there's two movies.
There's always two.
Even if more than two are out at the time, there are two that are really kind of dominating reality.
I like how this like inadvertently we have actually gotten some like ideas to stick with the two of you that like nobody's believing in the moist robot filter theory of reality, no, but that, we have but the two movie theory seems to actually be picking up some steam here. So
I don't feel like I'm watching the moist robots movie. I am in whatever the opposite theater of that is. I don't care what it is. We could be watching Saw, we could be watching Paw Patrol. Those were two movies that came out on the same day.
There you go.
But I'm not awesome. Whatever the voice robot movie is, I will watch any other movie.
Hard agree on that one. Well, with that, we should wrap things up. We've gone long today, but it's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate both of you, Calvin and Olivia, for coming on this journey with me as we dive deeper into the mind of Scott, going on a road trip into Scott Adams. We've got so much to pick from for episode titles. Whatever it ends up being will be, you know, the greatest hit that comes out in post here.
Yeah, all I know is that the Canva work on this one is going to take a long time to make it look good, to make the thumbnail look good.
Yeah.
But we'll figure it out.
We will, one way or another. We will produce this movie for all of you. From all of us here at Reverb, thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our show today was produced by Alex Helberg, Calvin Pollock, and Olivia Burnett, with editing work by Calvin. Reverb's co-producers at large are Ben Williams and Sophie Wadzak. You can subscribe to Reverb and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out our website at www.reverbcast.com. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ReverbCast. That's REVERB_CAST. If you've enjoyed our show and want to help amplify more of our public scholarship work, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice and tell a friend about us. We sincerely appreciate the support of our listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in.